Welcome to Hacking Your Leadership. I'm Chris, and welcome to today's guest interview. Our guest interviews are long-form interviews for leaders from around the world. They've each been selected because of their valuable perspective on leadership and work they've accomplished in this space. Today, we're joined by number one New York Times bestselling authors Adrian Gostick and Chester Elton, two people who have spent decades helping organizations increase employee engagement in a multi-generational workforce. They've just released their new book, Anxiety at Work, 8 Strategies to Help Teams Build Resilience, Handle Uncertainty, and Get Stuff Done, a book that is already topping charts after just a week on the market. Welcome, gentlemen. Say hi to our audience.
Delighted to be here. This is Chester, and I am Robin to Adrian Gostick's Batman. Adrian, over to you.
Hey, thanks, Chris, for having us on the show. Appreciate it.
Yeah, the pleasure is all over here. I want to start really quickly with just how the two of you came to, you know, meet each other, know each other, work together. It looks like that's been over a decade now. You know, how did that come to pass? And more importantly, how did you figure out that you both had kind of the same passions around this work?
Well, we began this about 20 years ago. You know, we were working for a big corporation. We decided to write the company's first leadership book because we were working with some cool clients. Wanted to say what we were working on with. Actually, at the time, it was employee recognition and how it could tie into employee engagement. Our work then expanded into culture. And lately, we're realizing that the biggest impact on culture is anxiety in the workplace, and managers just don't have a tool to deal with this with their people.
Yeah, it's been a real passion play for us for literally 2 decades. And how do you create great places to work? You know, if you look at all the data, Chris, so many people are not engaged at work. You know, that Sunday night, they get the pit in their stomach that they got to go back to work. And it's not fair and it's not right. So we've really dedicated our careers to say, what are the elements of great culture? So what are the attributes of great leaders? And boy, COVID really shone the light on the fact that, you know, anxiety is at an all-time high. If you're not addressing that, you're not going to get the best and the brightest. You're not going to retain good people, and you're not going to get to your goals. Now, I do want to point out really quick, and I always have fun with this at a little bit at Adrian's expense, that, you know, for 20 years, we've been writing under Gostick and Elton, except for this book. This book is Gostick and Elton and Gostick. So Adrian's son, Anthony, is a contributor and one of our co-authors, and brought a brilliant perspective of his generation and anxiety, and just really appreciated his contributions as well.
I love that. I love that answer. And I love that you he can follow in your footsteps. I have a son who's not old enough to contribute to writing a book yet. He's 9. But hopefully one day he and I can be a father-son writing or podcasting duo as well. The opening story, or one of the opening stories in your book, around Chloe and ghosting her company that she had spent time and effort getting to be a part of, it really resonated with me. The start of my own consulting company and what led me to leave a workforce where I was, you know, on a standard kind of W-2 income, was I was at a networking event where a CEO was talking, a small company, CEO was talking about how they had just spent a lot of time and effort trying to hire this person in a financial firm, and they needed a series of, like, you know, like all these different certificates, Series 7 and all these different things, an MBA. The hiring process took 6 months, and there was a lot of onboarding, and they found the right person who got along with everybody. And on about the fourth day, they just didn't show up at work after all of this. It was a six-figure job too. Person was like 28, 29 years old, and didn't show up on the fourth day, and no one could get a hold of them. No responding to email, no phone calls, nothing. And like months later, somebody else at the organization ran into them at a grocery store, a movie theater or something, and they just very nonchalantly said, "Oh yeah, it just wasn't what I thought it was going to be, you know, just wasn't. And there was, it was like this moment where this CEO, to his credit, said, he didn't look at that person as saying that person did something wrong, though in my mind, I think they did. The CEO said, "I don't know how to speak this language. I'm missing something, because there's no way this is the only place this is happening, and I don't know how to speak this language." Are you seeing this in the places you talk to, and at least on some scale? And why are leaders going through this right now?
Yeah, it's such a great question, because you're right, Chris. Every leader we have spoken with has a story similar to this. It may not be exactly the same. I love what that leader is saying. There's probably something wrong with us versus the person, because when that person in the grocery store said, "Yeah, it just wasn't what I expected," there's a lot behind there we're not hearing.
Yes.
It's not just, "Yeah, no, my desk wasn't pointed the right way." No. there was a lot of stress and anxiety, you know, my guess is, that was going on, where this person did not feel they understood their value. They didn't understand where they fit, if they had a future there, or even where the organization was going. So we're finding there really is a lot behind this. And so I love what the CEO said when they said, you know, it's probably something with us. We need to look in ourselves. And one of the things we're finding in this process is that a lot of managers are saying the younger generation, they have got to figure out how to work with us. Well, no, we have really got to change the way we are doing things if we want to be more empathetic and more able to retain top talent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Chris, you talk about the workplace for most of us is just not a safe place to talk about this kind of stuff. In fact, in our research, only 10% of employees said they felt safe talking about wellness or anxiety to their boss. So as Adrian says, you know, this ghosting, this disappearing, there's a lot behind that. We're sure of it. And what we're trying to do is trying to do three things, you know, with leaders. We say, look, you've got to normalize this conversation. Our generation would never talk about this stuff. You would check your personal life at the door. And if you started getting into this emotional stuff, you'd get shut down really quickly. What we found, and a lot with Anthony's help, is while we would never talk about it, the younger generations, it's kind of all they talk about. You know, they're so transparent and so, you know, self-aware. So this idea of creating not just psychological safety, we talk about emotional safety at work. So three things. You've got to normalize it. You got to say, look, everybody's dealing with it. And the data shows everybody is at some degree, right? Second is take that stigma away. That this isn't, you know, you being weak. This is you just getting well, like you would if you broke your leg skiing, right? And then thirdly is this empathy piece. And that's where I think the CEO you're talking about is trying to get to. We've got to figure out a better way to do this. We've got to figure out a better way to connect. And if you can do those three things, if you can normalize it, take the stigma away, and empathize, your odds of retaining brilliant people and creating a great culture and a great workplace go way up.
Yeah, I agree. I think I look at my dad's generation, and you know, I don't think work ethic was a commodity. Meaning, it seemed that everybody had it. You know, it was the price of admission. I think work ethic is a commodity now. Meaning, not everybody necessarily has it. But the causes of that lack of work ethic are different for each person, or the perceived lack of it. And so, if you have a company and you find one Chloe every 2 years, it's easy to say, we'll just not hire those types of people and we can move on. But when everybody or a large portion of the people in the workforce fall into that category, it becomes, you know, the old saying, if you owe the bank $100 and you can't pay, you have a problem. If you owe the bank $1 billion and you can't pay, the bank has a problem. You know, that's what this sounds like to me.
I couldn't agree more. It's a shift in how we manage. It's a shift in how we engage. And it's a good shift because, you know, the old school was you could leave work at 6 o'clock and no one could get a hold of you. You know, it was actually pretty great. Now everything's 24/7. We're global communities. You know, we've got time zones, we've got smartphones, we've got our laptops, we've got all these platforms that engage us, and we're expected to be on all the time. Well, that's the whole self. And as leaders and as companies, we can't just say, I just want the worker bee. Just give me that, right? You get everything. And that's what we're trying to get to is, look, this is going to come at the workplace. You need to address it. The good companies do. The great companies understand it at a deep level. And those that don't get it, don't get it. And, you know, good luck.
Yeah, never will. Yeah, what we're seeing too, Chris, is right now in 2020, the U.S. Department of Labor did some studies of this. They found 42% of people in their 20s have a full-blown anxiety disorder they are living with. And so that's almost half, right? So you got to assume this is pervasive in your culture. And Jester's right. If you're not dealing with it, you're going to get your lunch eaten. You know, others are going to start working on this and they're going to start working through this. You got to find ways to build up resilience and help your people.
Yeah, absolutely. Last week we posted published an interview with Jim Harder, who is Gallup's chief data scientist, talking about this exact same thing. And he said that from 2019 to 2020, the percentage of full-time workers of all ages who reported worrying at work daily rose from 37% to 60% in just 1 year, which is just enormous. And that's not even just the younger generation that you're talking about. That's everybody. Given that statistic, do you think that anxiety is rising in general, or is it pandemic? I mean, when this is over, the pandemic meaning, do we go back down to that 37%? I don't know that we do.
No, it's a great question. And you're right. We are seeing anxiety levels rising, but we began this work in 2018. We were seeing anxiety levels rising well before the pandemic. And what we were seeing is this is a generation that has grown up with a lot of anxiety, the people in their 20s right now. And you start thinking about what's happened. Well, first off, we have devices that are in their hands constantly, where they're constantly comparing themselves to others. That's their world of social media, where everybody's in this perfect world. And you're looking at somebody, oh, they're going on the cool family vacation. They got accepted into what school? You know, there's all this. You look at, you know, in your part of the world, of the scandals of, getting kids into college, because you can't just go into college anymore. You have to go to the right college. You have to go to USC. You can't go to Glendale Community College, you know, and so there's just all this stress and panic. We brought them into schools and we taught them active shooter drills. So they go to a movie theater and they're looking for where's the exit? Because if somebody comes in with a gun, all this anxiety and stress, it's not going away when the pandemic goes away. And what we're finding too right now, coming back to the work world, is the number one stress and anxiety for people in their beginning parts of their careers is whether my job will last. Job security is by far the biggest fear that people have.
I would just jump in on that too and say, how do you anticipate all of that? You know, you can't. And so you've got to understand it and you've got to empathize with it. I mean, you know, when I was in university or certainly in high school and college, it never occurred to me that someone would come in with a gun and try to kill us all. You know, I mean, that would be something out of a horror movie. And so when you've got that mindset, and, you know, we are, I mean, what do we teach our kids, right, Adrian? Stranger danger, right? And it's a different world. It's a different mindset. And as employers, you've got to understand that's what's coming into work every day. And by the way, don't want to paint the negative picture. The other thing that's coming into work is just brilliant minds that know how to collaborate and can use technology in extraordinary ways. So, you know, I always want to be careful as we have this conversation. We paint this generation that's just got so many phobias and so many problems. You know, don't we all? It just seems to be amplified in the digital world that we live in. Does that make sense, Chris? I don't want to go too far to the negative side.
No, it makes perfect sense. And that's that kind of brings me to the next question, which is do you think that this happens more in younger generations, or do you think it's just that they are okay with talking about it, which means it we think it's happening more?
I think that they've shone a light on it, and they've normalized it. You know, that first step, because sure, our generation dealt with. Of course we did. You know, there was always that pressure to get the promotion or get the better job or buy the nicer car. You know, competing with the Joneses was the mantra that we grew up with. I think what they've done is they've normalized it, and they're helping us to take that stigma away and say, listen, I understand, you know, we talk about the duck syndrome. I know you want me to believe that you're this beautiful duck just gliding across the top of the water, and you know, don't your feathers look great? And don't you, when we all know that what's going on underneath there to make that look so great is you're paddling like a lunatic. You know, you got a million things going. So I think we should be really grateful to the generation that said, look, this is an issue that's been here forever. We need to talk about it. We need to deal with it. We need to make it better.
Yeah, I think if I'm a non-duck and I'm watching all of the ducks on the surface, it could be very easy to think that that's what's going on is what I see on the surface. What I think is interesting is how even the ducks themselves, for some reason, think that they're the only one with that furious paddling that's going on underneath. What do you think it is that is stopping these individuals from looking at social media or looking at what's going on and knowing that, wait a minute, because I know myself, and I know when I post on social media, I only post the rosy colored things in my life. I only do that. why wouldn't I just naturally assume that's what everybody's doing?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And yet that is human nature, where we do assume we are the only. What the dirty little secret of anxiety that we've found out is that everybody has either is either suffering now or has had it at some point in their lives. There is an anxiety disorder. It's a clinical disorder that people live with all their lives. But there's also what we call transient anxiety, which kind of look back on your careers. Maybe you had just a terrible boss and you kind of had these mini T's that kept building up and building up until you were really in a state of anxiety. It was full blown. It was interfering with your life. You couldn't get away from it. We've all sort of had that experience. Well, that's the secret of anxiety. But unless we can share it, unless we can normalize this and begin the conversation, then people do feel alone. You know, the problem is that one of our stats that we found in the book is that only 1 in 10 employees feel safe talking to their boss about their mental health. And, you know, why so low? Well, you start thinking about it. When we talk to people, they go, well, you know, maybe I don't get that next promotion because they worry, can he hack it? Maybe they don't give me a nice assignment that I'm hoping to get that plum assignment next. You know, one of the biggest fears is, you know, the chatterbox. My boss will say it's in confidence, but then, oh, yeah, better not give it to Susie. She probably can't handle it. Oh, probably shouldn't have mentioned that, but she's, you know, and that type of stuff. So there's a lot of fear that comes in this. And that's where, again, it comes back to normalize, destigmatize, and empathize, as just Chester mentioned.
Yeah, and I will tell you, Chris, I think that's so insightful what you just said. Because, as Adrian said, I don't know what it is about human nature. We go it alone. And we think we're the only ones. You know, it's like my dad used to say, Chester, don't forget that there's nobody like you. You are singularly unique, just like everybody else. Right? And, yeah. and it's important. And one of the messages of our book is really that you are not alone. And don't think you're alone, because when you try to go it alone, it's a lot harder. And it's even more dangerous. You know, it's one of the reasons we created an online community called WeThriveTogether.global to create a community where it is safe to talk about anxiety and mental health. And you talk about, you know, do you have an emotionally safe place? Who do you reach out to? And we're trying to provide a couple of these things. And we tell leaders, look, and this is, we had a lot of pushback on this as we started to talk to leaders. They go, you're putting too much pressure on me. You're asking me not to just manage people. Now I've got to be their psychiatrist, their counselor, their rabbi. And we say, actually, we're not asking you to do all that. What we're asking you to do is, when people come to you with these issues, we want you to do one thing. Listen. Just listen. Right? And empathize. And together find that help. Just let them know they're not alone. And boy, if you can just take that first step, you can do a lot of good without having your PhD in, you know, psychotherapy.
I absolutely love that. In fact, I wish you could see my notes that I have in front of me right now. One of my bullet point notes for this interview is, you know, a question, now leaders or therapists, you know, like that's one of my bullet points here. And I think it's important because, you know, one of the reasons Lorenzo and I started this show is because we think there's a severe leadership deficit in the workforce. And we think it's caused by leaders being promoted for the wrong reasons. They were promoted because, you know, great economies produced great results, and then people thought that the results were because of the leader, not in spite of whatever they could have been doing better. And so you had people that get promoted into positions because they were really good at whatever the job was, which is a different skill set than leading a team of people to doing that same job. And so you have leaders who already feel in over their heads. They feel like they are one mistake away from being found out that it was the wrong move to promote them in the first place 20 years ago, you know, and they carry that with them. And again, now leaders are therapists. That now you're adding this on top of it. I'm not a trained therapist. I'm also not even a trained leader, meaning I'm leading because you threw me into the deep end several years ago and I'm doing my best. That's got to produce anxiety in and of itself in the leader who might not have even felt it before this.
No, you're so right, Chris. I mean, we've preached the same, is that we put people in positions of authority who have no right being, you know, leaders of people. They have no motivators that arranged around, you know, developing others or teamwork, etc. One of the things, I mean, we have an example actually in the book of how much anxiety this creates for everyone involved, including the poor leader who is asked to do this and has nothing, not a bone in their body. They would have been great individual contributors, but we all want to grow and develop. And organizations just do not put another avenue there for people. One of the examples that we have is a leader that will keep his name confidential, but you know, the organization was convinced this was the next leader of this really important team. As we have what we call a motivators assessment. We've now had more than 100,000 people take this assessment, but we had him take it. I think number 23 out of 23 of his motivators was developing others. Also down the bottom was ideas like teamwork. He was a great individual contributor. He really loved to work with clients, did great work with them. It was all about service and creative ideas. But, you know, they just went ahead. Within about 6 months, the team was rebelling. He was miserable. It just creates anxiety on the team if you do not put people in positions who can have that empathy. It's not something that just comes naturally to a lot of people. Leadership is a very different skill than being a great individual contributor.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, you touched on something that's really interesting too. It's the imposter syndrome, right? The leader that is saying, hey, I've got to play the role of the great leader and I've got everything together. We had a great nugget that we dug up on Oprah Winfrey when talking about the imposter syndrome. She said, you know, I've interviewed over 15,000 people. And she said, you know, from presidents, you know, like Obama and George W. Bush and leading, you know, entertainers and Lady Gaga and so on. And she says, at the end of every interview, they all say the same thing. How was it? Was that good? Was that good? Did I, you know, it's just, you know, she said Beyonce in all her Beyonce-ness. I mean, if you thought one person just really had it all together, even Beyonce said, hey, Oprah, was that good? They want this validation. They want to know that, you know, that what they did was good. And that's why, you know, our last strategy of the eight strategy is the gratitude piece to really reassure people that, yeah, what you do is important. It's valued. You made a difference. And when you made a difference, we noticed it and we celebrated it. So this whole idea that, you know, there are leaders that just have everything together all the time, it's just a myth.
Yeah, I agree. I love that story about Oprah Winfrey. I think she answered that when she was interviewed by Stanford's business school by one of the students at the Graduate School of Business there. And it was such a great moment when I heard her say that because it just shows a commonality that we have as part of the human condition of wanting to feel validated, of wanting to feel heard, of making sure that we did okay. Those people may not have said, how'd I do when they were playing in their space, whatever their forte was, but whatever they were doing at that moment was not something they normally do. And at that point, we're reduced to our lizard brain, right? I hope I did what I was supposed to, did I come off okay? Did I do okay? Was I heard? Was the message that I was trying to get across, is that what you took from it? And I think it's such a powerful thing. And it ties right back to what I think a lot of employees are wanting from their leaders. And if they're not getting it, it's a really quick way to disengage somebody and then eventually just make them leave.
Exactly right. And that's the part where putting the wrong people in the positions of authority is really problematic, because you're right. After the interview, they turn to the leader and the leader says, nothing. And that's what most anxious people are finding. It's a, you know, we talked to so many who said, I have to go to other people to say, am I doing the right work that I need to be doing? Because these leaders just do not understand that extrinsic motivation is very, very important for people earlier in their careers. The trouble is that psychologists look at motivation as this big thing. They look at everybody in every generation. And as we get older, we are more intrinsically motivated. I don't really need you to keep telling me what a great job I'm doing. Younger in my career, or as you said, Chris, when I step out of my comfort zone, that's when I need that reassurance. And if a manager just doesn't get it, that's really playing into this imposter syndrome too. I knew that I wasn't good enough to do this. And so what was interesting, but it's what we found too, so many of these young people we interviewed for anxiety at work, they would tell us, if my manager does not give me gratitude, does not help me feel validated for what I have done, I'll try my work in a different way next time, and the next way, and I'll just keep trying a different way until I finally get validation. How incredibly unproductive to have people just striving so hard for approbation when we as managers think, well, I'll tell you if you're not doing a good job.
It really is interesting that that simple little feedback loop, a leader that cares, that knows her team, knows who needs the pat on the back, knows who needs the kick in the bum. You know, it just makes all the difference. Our mantra for years has been, know your team, know your players.
Yeah, one of my mentors, a person that I have a lot of respect for, she once told me that every single career conversation she has with somebody sitting next to her starts out with two questions. And sometimes if you know them long enough, you don't have to ask it every time, but it's something that she goes back to every time, which is that one, do you know why this organization exists on the planet? And two, are you excited by that thing? Because if the answer is no to either of those two questions, the rest of this is going to suck. You know, that's what she says. And it's such a great starting point, because I think a lot of, because of what motivates us to do well, and I can speak personally, but I know this is true of a lot of people, is feeling like whatever I'm doing is contributing positively to more than just whatever that company's P&L is, right? And for me to do that, I have to connect the work I'm doing back to something bigger than myself, and I have to be excited by that. And if I can't figure out what that is, I don't inherently think, oh, my company's doing something wrong by not telling me. I might think, oh, I might be in the wrong place. I'm in the wrong spot here. And that's when I would go to leave. And I think leaders who can do that better, who can say, I need to be very intentional about connecting my people back to whatever this broader mission is and making sure they're excited about it, I think that checks off a lot of boxes when it comes to people just kind of looking for validation that they're in the right spot.
Yeah, no question. That emotional connection to work, and we talk about it quite a bit. You know, it's, I believe what I do matters. I make a difference and I'm validated for that. More and more, you know, and this again is, I think, something that the generations coming up are really good at, is finding the purpose in work, finding the mission. It's not just widgets, it's how does it impact the environment? How does it impact our communities? How does it create jobs? How does it create opportunity? One of the things that you touched on that we touch on in the book is this idea of a career path. You know, where do you want to be 3 to 5 years from now? What's the compact? And have that leader that says, you know, that's one of the biggest issues, nowhere to grow, you know? And it's really, and we had a great conversation in our podcast with a guy named Scott O'Neill. He's a big time executive in the sports world. And he said, you know, you got to really know where your team wants to go. I mean, each individual, where do they want to be 3 to 5 years from now? What are they curious about? How do they want to grow and develop? And he used the line that really stuck with me. He says, you may have somebody on your team that wants to go to the moon, and you should help them get there. And I thought, yeah, why not? You know, why not? Who wouldn't want to work for that boss? So this idea of mapping out your career reduces anxiety too, because to your point, it lets you know, where do you fit and where are we going? Adrian, what would you add to that conversation?
Yeah, I think, yeah, what you're getting at, I think is really powerful, because when we think of purpose, and even the two questions, which are great questions, do assume, look, what if you're making rubber chickens though? You know, what if you're working for an organization like, you know, like we work a lot with insurance, but sometimes insurance companies have to say, no, I'm not going to approve that claim. And that can be really hard for an employee working there. So what exactly is our purpose? So you've got to be very creative with this to say, okay, do you believe in what we stand for? Great. Here's where we're going as an organization. But are there ways that you can still work within here if maybe you do have some troubles with the purpose? We sometimes, you know, maybe we're working for a government agency and it's hard. It's a slog sometimes, but I can be the best help desk person possible. And I can be making sure that I'm helping do this, and this. That's really where it comes down to this personal idea. In a lot, for decades now, we have thought leadership is this big macro idea. We establish a purpose, we align people to that purpose. What we've realized though, that engagement numbers haven't moved. Why? Because we've been managing at this macro level. We have to manage at a micro level, and it's more work, I know. But when it happens, it's pretty magical. When you can align people with what they're going to contribute even if they may, not completely align with that mission, you got to find a mission for them within the team that they're really going to be passionate about. And it's possible, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. So there's an old kind of a proverb of a man walking down the beach, and he comes across a boy who's throwing crabs into the water, right? And there's thousands of them on the beach. And the man says to the boy, why are you doing that? There's thousands of them. You're not doing anything. You can't save them, or you're not making a difference. And he said, well, I made a difference to that one, as he threw it back in the water. And it's a powerful story. And I think that there are people who have a really difficult time understanding that there is value in that one that they helped, even though they're not solving the broader problem. And there are a lot of people who think, if I'm not in a room with the C-suite whiteboarding on how we're going to change the world, it means I'm not actually making a contribution. How do leaders get their people to understand or connect to whatever that small contribution is because of wherever they happen to be in their career or their position or their skill set or whatever that is, where they can feel connected to it, even if they're not sitting next to the CEO whiteboarding on how to change the world?
Yeah, those connections are so important. No doubt about it. And you do, you've got to manage to the individual. I hate organizations where they manage to the lowest common denominator, and again, as Adrian says, that's the macro level. Somebody breaks a rule. And so there's a whole bunch of new rules for everybody. You go, why don't you just go talk to the person that broke the rules? The old adage, let's teach them correct principles and let them manage themselves, and we'll deal with the exception instead of punishing the masses. I love the story of the crabs, or sometimes it's starfish, whatever your analogy is, right? We do need to manage to the one. We do need to figure out. And isn't that the nobility in all the great leaders that we venerate, right? Mother Teresa, who saves that one person, the old woman that she found left on the trash heap. And her goal was that no one should ever die alone or unloved. No one. Not all of us. No one. And her work was one person at a time. And you could say that, by the way, she failed miserably, right? There's lots of people that die alone and unloved. And yet, we love Mother Teresa because she took the time to make a difference for that one person. And that's what really great leaders do. They make a difference one person at a time.
I had a leader once a long time ago who was a very educated and seasoned HR professional. And, she kind of had an idea of how things should go. But when things didn't go the way that they should go, her response was always the same thing. It was, well, people are messy. And then she would move on, and it was this kind of acceptance of the fact that, we can't shoehorn people into what the book says they're going to do, because that's an aggregate. That says what a million people are going to do, not what this one person is going to do, obviously. And this idea of messy leaders is becoming a really powerful thing when it comes to the world that you two play in. Leaders who prioritize compassion over professionalism, the results over the process. How does this play into the leaders that you've seen and the successes they've had versus ones that aren't succeeding?
That is such an interesting concept. Just yesterday, Chester and I, we do a lot of executive coaching. And it was a concept that I was talking with one of my coaches, who's a CEO of a home healthcare network. And, there's a lot going on, as you can imagine, in home healthcare right now, because with all that's going on with COVID and everything. And then, of course, he's human too. Everything's happening in his life, and it's hitting him. And we talked about this concept of acceptance, and it's hard. There's an old, waxing religious for a moment, no matter what religion you're in. Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, was called Israel. And the reason was that he finally let God prevail in his life. Well, whatever you are, if you believe in a higher deity, if you believe in the universe is affecting us, at some point you have to realize it's just going to happen. And how accepting are we as leaders? Because that translates too into our anxiety levels that we're showing to others. Are we able to accept what is happening to us and realize we're not going to have control, especially in a crisis? What we found, one of the great stories in anxiety at work is a fighter pilot who actually told us that when they're flying in formation, she flew for the Thunderbirds. She says, when you're flying in formation and you hit turbulence, they taught me very early that you have to actually loosen your grip. Just two fingers on the stick. It's counterintuitive, I know, she says, but if you try to clamp up, you end up oscillating more. When we get into tough times, most managers want to micromanage. They want to, and that's actually what we can't do. You have to take your hands off the stick for a little while. You have to trust in your people. And really, that's going to come across as a lot more effective in the long run.
Yeah, I agree. This concept that you said, that you mentioned in the book, and it's on the cover of the book, around building resilience. Resilience isn't the ability to stop problems from happening. It's the ability to move through them and get out the other side and understand, oh, that wasn't so bad, or maybe it was bad, but now I know how to handle it in the future. You know, what should leaders be doing to help build that in their teams? Because I think that would take less ongoing effort than trying to stop the problems from happening to begin with.
Yeah, making it okay to fail is the hallmark, I think, of a great culture. You know, we got to know the CEO of WD-40 really well, Gary Ridge, and WD-40 means water displacement 40th formula. So you say, well, did they have 39 failures before they got to the 40th formula? I say, well, they say, we talk about learning moments, learning opportunities, not failures. You know, Tony's got a great line for us. We had him on our podcast that just dropped last week. He said, he's a scientist, you know, Anthony. And as Adrian and I joke, he takes classes and does stuff that not only do we not understand, we cannot spell. Like, we have no idea how to spell his classes. And he said, science is nothing more than failure with notes. And I thought that, so funny, Adrian, when he said that, I got to get that tattooed on my body somewhere, because that is just beyond brilliant. You've got to make it okay to fail. WD-40, this tribal culture that Gary has developed, where it's okay to fail. What did we learn from it? Like Adrian said, sometimes the failures are out of your control. Timing was wrong. Market was wrong. Formula was wrong. That's okay. What did we learn? What are we going to take forward? What are we going to try to do to make sure we don't have that kind of failure again? And yet when it does, let's embrace it and move on. Really quick, I came across this funny story. And it, again, like Tony's, it stuck with me. The guy said, when you talk about failure, he says, we could learn a lot from babies. And I thought, oh, this is going to be good, right? Because we just had a new grandson come into the world on Sunday, right? Said, well, you look at babies, they laugh all day long. And they are failing at everything, right? They're pooping their pants. They can't walk. They're falling down. They're making a mess. And they're laughing through the whole thing. Said, now, as the more evolved human, we are the adults. We laugh a lot less. And we hide our failures from everybody, right? That we could learn a lot from babies. I thought that was beyond brilliant.
That's great. And the other thing too, sort of building resilience. One of the things in building resilience is actually addressing the unknown, because that's right now what is the biggest factor is, you know, an organization say, well, we don't know what's in the unknown. Well, yeah, but why aren't you talking about it? Why aren't you saying, let's go into the unknown together with your people? And saying, you know, look, I'm going to let you know as soon as I do know something, but here's where we're heading. We talk about it often. And what do people want to know about the unknown? They want to know, do I fit? Which is coming back to the two questions, you know, your friend asked, which are great. But, you know, do I fit here? Do I have a future here as well? So am I adding value? And do I have a future? You know, there's a lot we can do when we really face the unknown together and not make it this mysterious thing that we're hitting into, because we will, as employees, fill the vacuum of the uncertain with fear, innuendo, rumor, etc.
Yeah, and I think the word there that you said, Adrian, that is just so key is we're going together. You know, the military talks about when they, you know, they parachute in behind the enemy lines. There's three things that you do. One is you stick together. You know, we're going to go through this together. Two is we're going to keep moving. And three is find the high ground. That thing of let's go together. You know, we love that you're loaning us your platform to promote our book, Anxiety at Work, right? Because we think it's really important to normalize, destigmatize, and empathize in the workplace. And it is available at fine bookstores every year. Don't make no mistake about it. I do want to tell you about another little book that I've just grown to adore, and it's called The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse by Charlie Mackesy. And it's this little boy going into the wild by himself, and he's afraid. Well, he gathers these friends, a mole, a fox that they save from a trap, and this big old gentle horse. And as they're going through the storms and going through the wild together, the little boy asks the big brute horse, "What's the bravest thing you've ever said?" And the horse says, "Help." And I think when you can create a culture where it is safe to ask for help, that we're in this together and we'll make it through the storms, as Adrian so brilliantly laid out, that's a place where people want to grow and develop and make a difference. And they will stick with you through tough times, and they will be allies and advocates for other people in your organization. I just love a culture that embraces that it's okay to fail. And by the way, it's okay to ask for help.
I love that story. And it speaks to a person or a horse who can say that, who can say help. To me, it implies that work was done prior to that in terms of the relationship, because you don't necessarily say help to just anybody unless you're really, really in trouble, right? And so I want to ask a question that ties back into a part of your book where you're talking about conflict avoidance and turning it into healthy debate. But first, a word from a sponsor. All right, we're here with Chester and Adrian. And right before that break, I was kind of teasing the process of turning conflict avoidance into healthy debate, something they talk about in their new book, Anxiety at Work. And you know, in my opinion, to me, that says that the relationship has to be there. Because to me, the difference between when I avoid conflict with someone versus I want to give my opinion, it means that I have a relationship with them where I feel like, even if they don't agree with me, they're at least not going to call me an idiot for saying it or start yelling at me or shoot me down for even voicing or interjecting my opinion. You know, to me, that says that that's not necessarily a leadership thing. If I'm your boss, I can't make a relationship happen between Chester and Adrian. I can't make that happen. That'll be forced. So how, as a leader listening to this show, can I do anything to try to make conflict avoidance turn into healthy debate, unless it's with myself and somebody?
Yeah, you've got to be open and honest to yourself as a leader. You've got to model that good behavior, right? Because the way you act gives everybody permission to act the same way. And so if you are a leader that incites conflict, a lot of leaders say, "Well, I love to pit my people against each other. I hate you. I'm never going to work for you," right? And this idea too, on wrapping up on help, I think a lot of us think that when we ask for help, whether it be around conflict or whatever else, we come across as being weak or we've given up. And I love this strategy that asking for help doesn't mean you've given up. It means you haven't given up because you're asking for help. Now, I want to pass it to Adrian, because in our research, we came across this idea of feedback, how leaders don't like to give it and yet employees crave it. Adrian?
Yeah, this comes to this idea of conflict. A lot of conflict is sort of interpersonal as well, as, you know, it's bigger debates within the team, but it's also one-on-one. Forbes has found that 9 out of 10 managers say that they are resistant in giving honest feedback to their people. Why? Well, they're just going to react badly. They're not going to listen. You deal a lot with this, Chris, in your work. What we find, however, is that almost 7 out of 10 employees say they feel shortchanged when it comes to getting feedback from their manager. So we get this huge disconnect. People want their manager to be open and honest, and yet managers are loath to give feedback. And yes, both sides are to blame here. The problem is not just managers being afraid, but employees sort of overreacting sometimes. And so, as we mentioned earlier, we tend to manage to the exception versus the rule. So this really is something where we have to create, and what we've seen with great leaders is they create ground rules for debate. They say, "Look, you know, I'm going to give you feedback. It's going to be open and honest. It's going to be meant with radical candor, but it's also going to be something for your good. I'm not just going to throw stuff at you just to be mean. I'm going to try to build, and I want you to grow, but you got to accept that too." And we've got to have a process here where we're going to realize we're going to have debates. And in team meetings, where you're setting ground rules for debate as well, where you say, you know, these are the four ground rules for debate. So people feel more comfortable and they're less anxious. You know, we will challenge the idea, but not the person. You know, we will try to use a piece of every idea that's thrown out. You know, those are not the ground rules you have to use, but you have to find ground rules that will help people feel less anxious, less on the spot or less challenged. Because, you know, the anxious among us, which are a lot, most of them will flee from conflict. And that's not what we're looking for. We need healthy debate in our teams.
Yeah, I mean, obviously all people crave feedback. They just want feedback to be delivered from somebody who has their best interest at heart, not the feedback giver's best interest at heart. You know, like there's a difference. If I give you feedback on how to make my life easier, that comes off differently than if I give you feedback on how to open doors in your career path, you know, and it could be the same advice, just told differently. But a lot of leaders, I think, really fail at that.
Yeah. And that comes down to trust, right? Do you trust your leader? You know, are you coaching me up because you have my best interest at heart? You want me to become a better, you know, leader? You want me to become a better manager? You want me to become a better person? Or are you coaching me in a way that leaves no doubt that you are a lot smarter than me and that whenever I screw up, you're going to be there, you know, in a lickety split. So, you know, this idea of trust is ever more important in the workplace. Do I really trust my leader, my manager? And I think that's why you're seeing so few people feel safe to talk about anxiety, because I may trust you when it comes to product development, or I may trust you when it comes to, you know, getting, you know, things done and being efficient in the workplace. I don't know if I trust you with my heart. I don't know if I trust you with my soul. And I know that's putting a lot again on managers. What we're saying is the whole person shows up to work. You've got to address the whole person. And we're not asking you to be a psychiatrist. We're asking you to be empathetic. We're asking you to say, hey, you're not alone. And I think those are all important messages that build what? Trust.
Yeah. And a lot of it, you know, in the past we would say, well, you refer people to the EAP. And, you know, so imagine what we say is, imagine you have a best friend who comes to you and says, I've got anxiety. I've got this mental health issue. And you tell them, go talk to somebody else. Go take some meds. You know, how long they're going to be your friend? What we find is that Chester's exactly right. People, 9 times out of 10, they just need somebody to listen and say, okay, we understand. If there are times that get overwhelming, come talk to me. We can work through this. It can be as simple as that in many cases.
You know, our audience are people who are in leadership roles and people who want to get better at it, or people who want to be in leadership roles. And if they're listening right now and they are seeing some of these symptoms, they're seeing an increase in workplace absenteeism, a decrease in engagement, a decrease in productivity, and the things that you're saying are kind of resonating with them a little bit. Besides, you know, going and buying the book, what can they start doing today or tomorrow as they go into work that might, if not like solve the problem immediately, at least make them feel like they are doing something productive towards not making the problem worse than it is?
Yeah. Well, I love that you started with go buy the book. Thank you for that. you know, we talk about in the book is to look for clues like you talked about. If somebody who's always on time is showing up late, if so, there are certain outbursts, things that are a little out of character. Now, if we're not looking for it, we'll think, well, that's a one-off, right? That's a one-off. If we are kind of aware that pretty much everybody is suffering from anxiety, those can be little clues, little heads up, where then we might, you know, arrange some time for a little bit of a one-on-one conversation. And we coach up a little bit on that. By the way, if it's happening, if Chris is maybe acting a little out of the ordinary, we don't want you to go up to Chris and say, Chris, I noticed that things are just a little off with you. Are you suffering from anxiety? what's the quote, Adrian? In the history of the world, no one has ever calmed down by having somebody say, hey, calm down, you know. So you come back to that empathy part and say, hey, Chris, listen, I noticed that your work isn't normally where it is. And I know we've got a lot going on. I know I do. With all the stuff that we've got going on and trying to get kids back into school or teaching them on Zoom or whatever. And I'm just wondering, is there stuff going on that maybe you want to talk about? Because we're all going through it. If there is, great. If not, just let me know. That one-on-one, that concern, looking for those clues really helps. And I know, Adrian, you're much better at this than I am. So
no, this is great. And I think especially starting with the work side, you know, Chris, you know, I see that, you know, you used to turn in really detailed reports. Last few have been a little light. Is there something going on in the work culture that I can help with? You're really starting with the work and letting them take you where they will go, and not having to be, you know, Columbo here. And nobody probably remembers who that is, but except for me and Chester. But, you know, but really being able to dig in a little bit more, but letting them, you know, go. You know, somebody recently asked us, you know, how do you manage somebody with anxiety? And Anthony, my son, who's 25, and as Chester says, a scientist, and, you know, who has real good insights on this, he said, you know, don't push. Open the door. It's just a better way of managing, period. You know, offering, you know, because people want to grow. Everybody does. Even those with anxiety, they want to stretch. They want to go new places. But instead of pushing them there, open the door, invite. And I just think it's just a better, a healthier way that we're starting to develop as leaders that's going to impact everybody in our care.
Yeah, I love how you put that in the context of the whatever the problem could be is external, not internal. You know, like I noticed a drop in your productivity. You know, what's wrong? I noticed a drop in the productivity. Is there something going on around here at work that is causing an issue? Almost like giving the employee an out to say, if I say yes, I'm not saying yes, I've done something wrong. It's allowing them to say that maybe yes, something has changed. In terms of just, you know, inviting that conversation to happen. And I think that probably will lessen the level of defensiveness that a person might naturally gravitate towards if it was phrased differently. That's just brilliant. I really appreciate that. Gentlemen, I really appreciate your time here today. I think the book is fantastic. I'm halfway through it right now. I will finish it because it's an enthralling read. And I think the people that I lead in my life and the corporations that I consult with will benefit from it as well. What's an ask of the people listening right now? Obviously, besides going and buying the book, is there a website they should visit or a specific web address or LinkedIn or, you know, what? How can they interact or engage with you?
Thanks, Chris, for asking that. And we have actually a book website, anxietyatworkbook.com, where it's got lots of free giveaways and some other information. If you're still unsold, we would love you to connect with us on LinkedIn. It's Adrian Gostick and Chester Elton, and also adriangostick.com, chesterelton.com. So lots of places to connect. And Chris, we just want to thank you so much for allowing us to come on and share a few ideas today. This has been terrific.
Yeah, I just want to second everything Adrian said there. You've been a gracious host. You've been so engaged. We love that you love the book. And we do think it's going to make a difference. It's the number one issue in the workplace today. And the fact that it is so stigmatized just isn't fair. And it's not right. And if we can right that wrong and reach out and make a difference to people where they don't have that knot in their stomach Sunday night, they're eager to go to work, they've got bosses they can trust, teammates they can trust, and they feel emotionally safe, well, that's good work, and we really appreciate you help us getting that message out. So thanks again.
I wholeheartedly agree. Thank you both for your time today.